It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Representative Mark Pocan joins us to talk about COVID-19 and recent issues regarding test records being removed from the CDC website. First, ready-to-eat cereals continue to dominate their share of the market, but oatmeal has been making up some ground over the last few years. According to a market research firm in Chicago, dollar sales in the hot cereal oatmeal category surpassed $1.3 billion in 2018, up 1.3% from the previous year. Maybe it's the convenience, the healthiness, the variations, or the low cost. Whatever the case, oatmeal appears to be hot. And if you're not into sitting down to a big bowl, there's always oatmeal cookies, cake, muffins, pancakes, the list goes on and on. We'll cover as much of it as we can during this edition of Food Friday. Christy Morrison is the senior editor of special projects at America's Test Kitchen. Christy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be here.
Now, are you an oatmeal eater yourself, and how do you like it, if so?
I am. I love oatmeal. I like to make a batch at the beginning of the week, and I kind of play with my mix-ins and maybe do some dried cherries one week or some orange and cranberry another week or stir in some almond butter. You know, I like to, variety is good.
Now, before we dig into more variety and the varieties of the oats itself, just in general, in the food world, it seems like, you know, oatmeal is not exactly your glorious ingredient, the one that everybody wants to talk about. Does it get kind of overlooked amidst all the other fancier, trendier ingredients?
Well, I guess it could, but I kind of think, you know, when you were talking about the sales going up, it seems like, you know, it's one of those classics and people tend to, you know, we see a lot of kicking it old school kind of lately. So, I mean, yeah, it's not as sexy as like farro, I suppose, but, you know, it's consistently good. It's easy to find and it's relatively inexpensive.
Let's talk about the different kinds of oats out there. There's rolled, which is honestly what I usually use. There's quick. There's the steel cuts. People seem to like some other stuff. Tell us how to tell us apart and what they're good for.
Sure. So, steel cut are the least processed of most of the oats that you would find. They basically are just the oat groat, which is the grain without the husk on it, and it's chopped up. So it's still pretty dense. It takes longer to cook than other kinds of oats, but it holds on to more of its nutritional value. It's got more nutty flavor and chewier when you eat it. So it's great in oatmeal. Rolled oats start with the same grain, but they're steamed first and then they're rolled, hence the name, through heavy rollers. So they become thinner and, you know, between the steaming, which makes them quicker cooking, and the increased surface area that you have, they take a lot less time to cook. So rolled oats or old-fashioned oats are what you find for a lot of oatmeals, but also what you would use if you were making, you know, like a crumble or a crisp for a topping. It's probably what you would use in most muffins or baked goods. And then instant oats or even quick oats. Quick oats are rolled even thinner than rolled oats. So, you know, obviously less time to cook. And instant oats are kind of chopped up and rolled and pressed. So, you know, they take no time. But the more processed they are, the less flavor you're going to have. So, you know, steel cut oats are way more flavorful and chewy in texture than rolled or quick oats.
And we've got your recipe for 10-minute steel cut oatmeal posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. What's the best way? How do we take those steel cut oats and make some great oatmeal out of them?
I love this recipe. And this is no joke. This is the one that I use all the time. So steel-cut oats can take up to 40 minutes to cook, which is not ideal in the morning, obviously. So you take them and you boil most of the water that you would use to cook them over at night. Add the oats, put a lid on the pot, turn off the heat, and let them sit while you sleep. And then when you wake up, they take about 5 minutes to simmer, and then they sit for 5 minutes off the heat, and they're done. So it's just a great method that takes this longer cooking grain and makes really easy work out of it. And you still get all the flavor and you can always stir in some ingredients. It's a simple approach to the you know, the most clear-cut kind of oatmeal.
Christy Morrison is with us from America's Test Kitchen. It's Food Friday. We're bringing oatmeal back. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite ways to cook oatmeal or make other stuff with oats or your questions for Christy. Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Janesville. Tom, hello.
Well, hello. I just thought I'd call in with my favorite oatmeal recipe, and I've been doing it for years, and I actually prefer rolled oats. And what I do is put like a half a cup in a bowl, put enough milk on it to just come to the top, put it in the microwave for 90 seconds, and it soaks it up and becomes nice, but it's still a little chewy, you know, like she likes her steel-cut oats. And then I put on a little cream, a pat of butter, and a couple dashes of Louisiana hot sauce.
Ooh, okay. Tom, thanks a lot for sharing that. And Christy, I know some people, you know, I guess I'm old-fashioned or something. I just, you know, put on maybe the butter and cream and maybe brown sugar. A lot of people like savory versions of oatmeal. Can you talk about, like, that hot sauce version? Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, Tom, you can make breakfast for me anytime. That sounds great. We actually did a couple different variations with savory flavors in mind, where, you know, while you're waiting for the oatmeal to cook, you can saute some mushrooms and onion and maybe stir in some spinach to make it wilt, and then mix it in just like you would if you were making risotto. Or, you know, if you think of the oatmeal more like polenta or grits, which it's, you know, a very close cousin to, you know, it wouldn't be odd at all to put savory ingredients on top of those. So you can use oatmeal in exactly the same way. Just, you know, don't put your sugar in when you add your pat of butter, and you can play with all sorts of things.
Yeah, it's a little weird. We've taken this one grain, oats, and decided that's for breakfast. When in fact, right, you could use it in a place where you use a lot of different kinds of grains in for, you know, for lunch or dinner or whatever.
Exactly, exactly. And I also think, you know, a lot of people like savory breakfasts. You know, they like eggs with hot sauce and things like that, but you wouldn't think of making oatmeal that way. So, yeah, it's very versatile.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Eau Claire. Lynn, hello.
Good afternoon. And here's your savory breakfast. It's Gritzwurst.
Gritzwurst.
Gritzwurst, and you can find it in older cookbooks. I learned to make it from my mother-in-law. It was generally made around butchering time with leftovers. I use boiling or cheap cuts of beef and pork, steel-cut oats, onions, and predominantly, it's allspice. That's the and it's amazing. I will put the recipe on the Facebook page, and it's labor intensive, but it's really worth it. And I make it like 40 pounds of it at a time.
Wow.
Because my family loves it.
No,
it's amazing.
I got to ask, it's got worst in the name. Do you actually make it into a sausage at the end of it?
Like a... No, you it's bulk.
Okay.
And we it's cooked, and then we freeze it, and then you take it out and you put butter in a pan. And then you get it all crispy and fry it up. And then we spread it on toast.
Wow.
It's decadent.
Lynn, thank you so much. I hadn't heard of that. Go ahead, Christy.
It sounds a little like Scrapple. Or, we did a recipe in Cook's Country. I forget. It was like Geta, maybe. But it's definitely a similar thing where you use a grain and some cheaper cuts of meat and almost make a... Like you'd make a patty out of it and fry it, and it's a delicious way to stretch food and make something really delicious, especially for breakfast.
Lynn, thanks for sharing Gritzwurst with us. It's Food Friday. We're talking about the many uses of oatmeal. Christy Morrison is with us, senior editor of special projects at America's Test Kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you like your oatmeal? What do you put in it or on it? Are you looking for ideas to jazz up your bowl? Or do you cook different things? Do you bake with oatmeal? Do you do savory dishes with oats in it in one form or another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can find a few recipes that Christy has shared with us over at wpr.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Christy Morrison from America's Test Kitchen. It's oatmeal today. We've got three of Christy's favorite oatmeal recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. 10-minute steel-cut oatmeal, classic chewy oatmeal cookies, and turkey meatloaf with ketchup brown sugar glaze, which I thought was a mistake, but it has oats in it too. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your oatmeal favorites. Christy, we have full phone lines, which we always do. Oatmeal is caller gold for some reason. But before we go to some more callers, I want to check out another recipe, the classic chewy oatmeal cookies you shared with us.
Yeah, let's talk about them. They're delicious.
Yeah, what makes them so good? And again, this is America's Test Kitchen version of a classic. It means you've done the lab work. You know what's really going to come out great.
Right. And these actually started by looking at the back of the Quaker oat tub, like lots of people do. But we wanted a really chewy, oaty cookie that was crispy on the edges and chewy and dense in the middle. And part of the way we got there was by using melted butter. And we ended up browning it to give it even more flavor. Getting rid of a lot of excess flour so that the oats are really front and center, and using some vegetable oil also. And that combination with the melted butter just gave us this great chew. I like them without the raisins. I know that's, you know, heading into really sketchy territory.
But I'm right there with you.
but they're so good and really easy to make too.
You can find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. Back to your calls now. Catherine is with us in Wanakee. Catherine, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What do you want to share?
I absolutely love steel cut or Irish oatmeal, I believe it's called, with fresh cranberries, or I'll have them frozen in the, keep them frozen. Brown sugar. I cook cranberries, oatmeal, brown sugar all together, and then I throw walnuts in at the end. I'll make an entire batch at the beginning of the week and eat it all week. And I always eat it with butter, never with cream or milk, and it is delicious.
And Catherine, is this something you have just about every day, or is this something you kind of come and go with?
Well, just about every day. It's so good for you. It will, you know, it'll last. You don't get hungry until, if you have it at 8 o'clock, you don't get hungry until 3. So it's really an amazing breakfast.
Catherine, thank you so much for sharing that. Christy, do you have any other berries or nuts you like to mix in with the oatmeal?
Oh my goodness. Well, I love pecans in my oatmeal. Catherine, that sounded delicious. I'll have to try that. I'm with you on the butter. Any dried fruit is great. We also have done, I've shredded apples and mixed that in towards the end too. So, and kind of done like an apple cinnamon. That's good. I really haven't put a fruit in there that I didn't like. Banana and almond butter might be one of my favorites.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Wanda now in Sun Prairie. Wanda, hello.
Hello. I'm calling with, and I'm glad nobody said it yet, but I found a recipe for an oatmeal smoothie. And you start with a half a cup of dry oats. You don't cook them at all. Put them in the blender and blend them up. And then you put in a banana, and then strawberries, blueberries, blackberries, whatever berries you can find. And then a half a cup of milk, and blend it up with an ice cube or two. And I've been doing it every morning for, I'm a teacher, so a whole school year. And I've lost weight. I feel great. And it's really my only trick that I've changed in my diet.
Wow.
Really, really good.
Wanda, thank you so much. And I do that sometimes with my smoothies, start out by grinding up some oats. I say sometimes because my wife doesn't like it. So it's only when I'm making smoothies just for Rob. Christy, have you put oats in smoothies ever?
I haven't. I think that sounds great. I have done the overnight oats, you know, where you just mix them with milk or yogurt and let them soften overnight. But I really like that idea of putting them in the smoothie. So it's kind of like using oat milk, except much less expensive. And, and you've got all those vitamins and nutrients and oh, that sounds great.
Thanks for the call. Susan joins us next in Glendale. Susan, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
How do you like your oatmeal, Susan?
This is, everybody says this is very strange. I'm 63, and when I was about four, we spent 7 months in Germany with my mom's family, and I had a cousin who made for breakfast in the morning raw oatmeal, not the quick cook. It had to be steel cut or the other one. And he would put some in a bowl, add a little milk to make it moist, and then add sugar, and they used Nestle's Quick, which is what we always used, and I absolutely love it to this day.
Huh. So it's just kind of like using the oats as cereal, pretty much. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. You just let it sit for a little while, and it gets real nice and chewy and nutty. But people are totally grossed out by eating it raw.
And that's not so weird. They put oats in, like, granola, right, Christy? Is that weird?
Sure. No. I mean, as long as, you know, you didn't chip a tooth or anything, if you let them sit in and you were using the steel cut, you said, right?
She did, yeah.
Yeah. I think that there's so much you can do with oats and oatmeal. And, you know, if it's working for you, then it's great, especially in these kind of applications where you're not baking with it. It's really not going to matter as long as it's to your taste.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. Christy Morrison is with us from America's Test Kitchen. We are cooking with oats and oatmeal. And this was the surprise recipe to me. Oats involved in this one, a turkey meatloaf. What are the oats? What are they doing there?
Well, you know, we usually put some kind of a panade or, you know, some bread and some milk in meatloaf to kind of keep the meatloaf juicy. Turkey meatloaf is a lot harder because it's really lean, and turkey tends to cook up kind of mushy and not have a lot of texture. So we found that using some quick oats in there helped to keep the turkey from just binding together into a stiff mass. And it also helped soak up some of the turkey's juices and keep all the moisture inside the turkey loaf. And it was really good and kind of off the wall, sort of.
One key tip in the recipe was don't use the super lean, the like 99% fat-free ground turkey. You want something with a little bit of fat in it here.
Right. And that's going to give it more flavor too. I mean, it's already relatively lean compared to ground beef or meatloaf mix. And so definitely want to use the 93%. And in this case, we liked quick oats. Although if you take some rolled oats and chop them up, they'll work too.
Go back to some of our many callers on oatmeal. Carol is with us in Mosinee. Carol, hi.
Hi there. Hey, I make my own granola about every 2 weeks with real maple syrup. And then in the mornings, I found this amazing thing. I use half. I do the granola. I always put ginger in my granola too when I'm making it. Fresh ginger when I'm drying it out. And then I just found that if I do half almond milk and a little bit, maybe not quite half, unsweetened coconut milk from the can, mm-hmm. not the hard part on top that condenses, but the juice in there, it is like ice cream on top of granola. It's fantastic.
Sounds pretty rich, Carol. Thanks a lot. Advice on making our own granola, too. Christy, what do you think of Carol's suggestions there?
I think that sounds great. Coconut milk, you've got me pretty much any way you want to use it. I think that's great. The thing with granola, you know, you can make it leaner, you know, by adding more oil or more butter. You can add different flavors to it. But I think it's then, you know, how you use it. I even like to sprinkle a little granola on my oatmeal. So I know that I'm, you know, like oat on oat, but it's nice to have the different textures.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. My thought about oatmeal is that when it's mixed after it's cooked, if you mix it with applesauce in your dish and also mix in some walnuts, or maybe some other kind of nut, whichever you might prefer. But a combination of oatmeal and applesauce is just wonderful.
Ooh, that sounds great. Christy, mixing in something like applesauce, like kind of a similar but different texture there mixed in.
Sure. And then you don't have to worry about, you know, if adding fresh fruit, you have to kind of let it soften or pre-cook it. The applesauce is already done. It's already sweetened. I think that's a great mix in.
Thanks for the call. Patty joins us next in Madison. Patty, hello.
Hello. Okay, so I love steel-cut oats, and I have figured out a way to give it a more toasty, nutty flavor. I take my steel-cut oats, probably about a quarter of a cup, and gently saute them in butter for about 10 minutes and get them toasty. They almost even pop, like popcorn. But then I throw that into the boiling water and proceed to cook it for the 20 minutes or so. But I do that with lots of different grains, and steel coat oats, it really works for me. So wanted to share that.
Pre-sauteing the oats in butter, Christy.
I'm totally on board. I mean, we do that with our couscous, and a lot of times with rice if we're doing pilafs. I mean, just adding some of that browning, you're at, you know, bringing out the sugars and the nutty flavor. Oh, Patty, I'm on board.
Thanks a lot for the call. Time for one more caller on Food Friday. Beth is with us in Milwaukee. Beth, hi.
Hi. So this is the official breakfast for my ski racers at the Great American Brookabiner every year. And it's a Morning Glory pancake where you soak the oatmeal overnight in buttermilk. And then the next morning you mix it with flour and eggs and baking powder, a little bit of sugar, and then fry them up and serve it with walnut butter.
And that keeps people going on the trail all day?
It keeps them going on the trail, and I started it 1 year, and now they demand it every year.
I love it.
The 1 year, my youngest kid beat his older brother. He swore it was the pancakes that were the reason.
Beth, thank you so much for sharing that. Christy, just a few moments left. Any of the ideas you heard from our listeners that you're going to try this weekend?
Oh, my gosh, those pancakes sound fantastic. I also really love the cranberry, you know, mixing the fresh cranberries in, too. That sounded interesting. There's just so many things you can do with oatmeal. And you know, you can kind of, most of the time, you don't have to decide until right at the end. So if you're wishy-washy like I am in the morning about what I feel like, it works great.
Christy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Christy Morrison with us from America's Test Kitchen. Find some oatmeal recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Less than a month before opening day, Major League Baseball is trying to figure out how to prevent teams from cheating. Coming up, we'll look at the latest in the aftermath of the Houston Astros sign-stealing scandal. Now, Congress approved an emergency spending bill this week that will address the growing outbreak of the novel coronavirus, the cause of the illness known as COVID-19, in the United States. President Trump signed that bill today as the number of confirmed cases of the virus surpassed 100,000 worldwide. There have been 14 deaths so far in the U.S., according to Johns Hopkins University. But as the country moves to get a handle on the outbreak, there's been some criticism of information not being readily available from agencies like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Our next guest joins us to talk about his concerns about the way the CDC is handling testing and what he thinks should be the response from the federal government. Representative Mark Pocan is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison. Representative Pocan, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Big picture, before you dig into some details, how do you think the United States has handled the COVID-19 outbreak so far?
Well, I think I can say the good news is this week Congress got together in a very strong bipartisan way and put together a pretty substantial package of aid that can go out in a number of different ways. Quite different than, you know, what the president put out. We're not stealing money from the Ebola virus. So I think that was positive, but we're still pretty seriously lacking in a couple areas. One is in testing. We've been really behind in producing test kits, even I think worse that we're not proactively testing the right type of people like we should right now. For a while, we quit keeping track of how many people we tested. We thought that was a very bad idea, and the CDC did decide to listen to us and start keeping track of that again. But also just from the very top, you know, the president has in the last week done everything from calling this a hoax to saying people with the coronavirus can go to work. All of those are bad pieces of advice. We think the best advice is what the doctors who are involved in this are telling us. wash your hands on a regular basis, cough into your elbow, and do your very best to not touch your face. You do those three things, and you're doing, I think, the most you can right now to make sure you're in good shape.
Now, as you mentioned, Congress passed this over $8 billion emergency spending package. What kind of things is that going to go for?
A lot. Trying to get test kits out there, trying to work towards a vaccine, trying to make sure their local health departments are getting funds as they're trying to process tests, looking at things like telemedicine. There's a lot of different pieces to it, and that's good. The concern, though, is I think as of today, there may be only enough tests out there for about 75,000 people to be covered out of 330 million. That's pretty pathetic at this point. By the end of next week, we think that number will be considerably higher. But what we're still not doing is proactively going into hospitals and testing people with pneumonia-like symptoms and then testing the healthcare personnel, because that's what we're being told by people like the former czar for the Ebola virus and the Obama administration. Those have been some of the advice that he's given. We think that's very sound. So we still have to change some practices. We're still trying to get the CDC and the FDA in some cases to do things a little quicker and a little better.
California Governor Gavin Newsom announced yesterday that residents of his state can get tested for COVID-19 free of charge. He's directing health providers and insurers to make that happen. Not clear exactly how the authority works and how the money is going to work there. Do you have thoughts on that move and whether you think other states should follow that lead?
You know, I think that's a very good lead. We tried to get that done at the federal level. We couldn't get that done with the Republicans in the Senate. And yet, you know, there's been the stories in the media, unfortunately, of people who've gotten tested, were negative, and then they got a $3,200 bill. That's going to spook people from doing what they need to, especially if they have any symptoms. So we think that's a very good idea that people, when you're facing what could be a pandemic, should be able to get that testing and not have to worry about a bill. Really, for certain populations, especially those over 60 or with other ailments, this can have a much more problematic. In fact, 15 to 20% of the people who get the coronavirus will likely require some hospitalization. So we just need to get the proper scientific information out there, get people tested, be proactive in doing that. And I think the move the governor did is a good one in California.
Talking to Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan, a Democrat representing the state's second district, which includes Madison, looking at the federal response to the novel coronavirus, the cause of the disease, COVID-19. Representative Pocan, we're reacting here with this funding package. Is there something more we could be doing to be ready to have the public health infrastructure in place, maybe more than we currently do for, you know, an outbreak like this or whatever the next one might be?
Yeah, no question. A number of things. Again, most immediate is testing of people, knowing what that what demographics and what areas in the country are seeing spikes. By us early in the week when they quit keeping track of that information and posting it, you know, you don't even know what you don't know if you don't keep those kind of records. And I think that now, hopefully, we've turned the corner at least keeping track of the information. But we have to be more proactive. Also, we're learning things about our supply chains, whether it be prescription drugs, many of which are made in China. The active ingredients in prescription drugs, even drugs that are made in other places in the world, are often made in China. And our medical devices, we have to keep track of. And right now, we don't really have a comprehensive mapping of all of those, so we don't have any drug shortages. Mike Gallagher, Republican from the Northeastern Wisconsin, and I, along with Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri, introduced a bill this week to try to deal with some of that on medical devices. But I have been pushing many of the different agencies through my appropriations committee and through hearings to be collecting more information, including those active ingredients for drugs. We need to know, or else you're not going to know when you might have a shortage.
Now, one message I hear from public health professionals is, yes, this is a serious situation, a serious disease, but nothing is helped. If there's panic, we don't want to overreact. Do you have thoughts on, you know, taking it seriously, but not freaking out here?
For the vast majority of people, if you wash your hands on a regular basis, you're coughing into your elbow, you're not touching your hands to your face, which, believe me, is difficult. As they told us that, I was holding my face in my hand during the briefing. If you do those three things, you are doing about as much as possible right now to make sure you don't get it. But for certain populations, people who are over 60 in nursing home environments, with other ailments, it can be much more severe. And as we said, 15 to 20% from what we think right now will likely have to be hospitalized. And we're still trying to deal with exactly what that mortality rate is. But where we see the most problems in places like Washington State for people in nursing homes, it's had some really severe impact. So common sense really should dictate, don't let it be panic. But we have some things that we've got to do better, not just for this virus, but getting ready for the future.
As you mentioned, a state like Washington has been at the center of this. Wisconsin, not, at least not yet. Only one confirmed case brought in from out of state, some other people being tested. What do you think of the level of cooperation between the federal level and state levels around the country?
Again, I think it's improving. We need to get more tests out and we need to get more testing done. But, I've been following Dr. Anthony Fauci. I think he's giving the best information that's out there. I've been following the former FDA commissioner under Donald Trump, Scott Gottlieb, who's putting some really good information out there. I'm following the World Health Organization. Scott Gottlieb has said a while back now that he thinks there are hundreds, if not thousands, of cases in the United States, many of them quite light, but we're not testing, so we don't have those numbers. So really, we have to treat this not like a political crisis, not as an economic crisis first, but as a healthcare crisis. If you do that, you will solve all the other potential crises that could occur.
With this new funding passed by Congress, signed by the president, when will that start to have an impact on testing levels around the country?
Well, it's going to have an impact on a lot of areas. Testing really has just been, unfortunately, they had some missteps in the very beginning that slowed us down. Right now, they've got a lot of private facilities producing tests. So by the end of next week, it should be into the low millions of people who can get tested. And again, it doesn't have to happen for every person if you don't have symptoms. But if you are in a hospital setting or a healthcare setting, you should be tested. We're hearing about some nurses in California who've been quarantined who can't right now get tested. That's ridiculous. We need to take care of our healthcare personnel first and foremost. So we're still trying to improve. We're trying to get things done better. And I just hope we do this as a medical issue first and foremost. And if we do, we're going to come out of this in a lot better place.
Representative Pocan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Mark Pocan is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison. He joined us today to talk about the progression of COVID-19, the CDC decision to remove testing numbers for a while from the agency's website. They have come back, and other related issues. Coming up, we'll get a take on the Houston Astros cheating scandal and how Major League Baseball is trying to rebuild trust in the game. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, northern Wisconsin's Telemark Lodge has been a winter sports destination for decades, but it's been dormant since 2013. We'll find out about a new plan to redevelop it during our state news roundup. Now, after an offseason that was dominated by the Houston Astros cheating scandal, Major League Baseball is trying to restore some sanctity to the game. Houston won the World Series in 2017, but this past November, one of their players told The Atlantic they stole signs electronically. Basically, they used a center field camera to see what kind of pitch the opposing team's catcher was telling the pitcher to throw after decoding the signals. That would then be relayed to the Astros' dugout. If it was an off-speed pitch like a curveball or changeup, somebody on the bench would bang on a trash can. You can hear it in the TV broadcast of an Astros-White Sox game in September 2017. That was the bang-bang sound there. The White Sox pitcher was quoted as saying he heard that every time he was about to throw a changeup during that particular at-bat. In January, the league fined Houston $5 million and took away several top draft picks. The team later fired their manager and general manager. No players were disciplined, and the team will not have to forfeit their championship. Now, a couple weeks into spring training, Major League Baseball is trying to make it clear to teams what they can and can't do. Jason Gay is a sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal and a UW-Madison alum. Jason, good to have you back on the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Well, big picture, Jason, this Astros sign-stealing scandal, what's your reaction? What do you make of this?
Well, this is now a couple months into it, and I'm telling you, people are still hot. Fans are hot. Opponents are hot. People outside of baseball find the whole thing hilarious. We haven't even gotten to opening day, and I feel like we've gone through like 6 or 7 chapters of this saga, and it could get really spicy as the baseball season begins. People are ticked off that the Astros did what they did. they feel they didn't, you know, adequately apologize. And it really is this going to be this interesting sideshow, because baseball now has a true villain. You know, traditionally it's been the Yankees, you know, the big bad Yankees. But now I think even the Astros have out Darth Vader'd the Yankees.
Wow. Now, people outside of baseball might be seeing sign stealing. Is that really so bad? How bad is what they did?
You mean people who aren't baseball fans are okay with stealing?
I guess. Fine. I don't know these people.
No, listen, there is a kind of interesting distinction you have to make here, because as you say, and it's true, sign stealing is as old as baseball. People have been doing this forever. Usually it was a runner on second base who would try to figure out what the catcher was signaling to the pitcher, would try to relay that to the bench or to the hitter at the plate. And when it was kind of lo-fi, just person to person, it was just an accepted part of the game, that kind of subterfuge. What the Astros did by sort of kicking it to another level with technology and video review and analytics and banging on a trash can was just over the top. And it's obviously what the manager and the general manager were sanctioned for. And I think, you know, even in the sort of low level skullduggery that exists in every sport, frankly, this was just a grade above.
A while back, the Astros did this sort of apology thing with a handful of people. You wrote about it at the time. You were underwhelmed, I think it's fair to say.
Well, they kind of just punted. I mean, if you got a chance to see it, it was the Astros owner, Jim Crane, and put poor Dusty Baker, who's the replacement manager, up there apologizing for goodness knows what, because Dusty didn't do anything. A couple players got up there and did these mealy-mouth apologies. And, you know, the perception, not just outside of the game, but within opponent dugouts, was these guys got to do better than this. I mean, we got to see at least a little bit of contrition for what they did, because, you know, they're trying to paint this as kind of low level stuff. It didn't really affect games. Well, if it didn't affect games, why'd you do it for as long as you did? Why'd you try to hide the fact that you did it? It just didn't check out. And so, I mean, it just was a, you know, they teach these things in business schools, right? Great PR flubs. This will go down with the best of them or the worst of them.
How much of a difference maker is this in Major League Baseball, being able to tell the batters at least some of the time what the next pitch is going to be?
Well, listen, you know, like you, it's been a long time since I've been hitting Major League pitching. But I can tell you that, you know, if someone tells you you're going to get an off-speed pitch or the fastball's coming or even the breaking pitch, knowing that information in advance is a distinct advantage for a professional caliber hitter. And you saw a lot of pitchers come out after the fact here and say that they would rather somebody loaded up on every steroid in the book than someone getting the signals in advance. You know, especially when you're talking about, you know, important situational pitching, 3-2 counts, bases loaded, that sort of thing. If you're giving the hitter knowledge about what is coming next, even if the thing that's coming next is 102 miles an hour, that's an advantage. No question about it.
You mentioned how mad players are. And I think when we watch NFL or NBA, we're used to hearing a lot of trash talk and, you know, rivalries and kind of that bitterness from team to team, player to player. Is this something we usually see in baseball, or did this bring out something that we don't usually see?
No, and that's a good distinction, because I think that's something that baseball is caught off guard by, and why Major League Baseball itself, the organization, is under the gun, because I don't think they anticipated other teams being as aggravated as they did. They created the situation. You know, if we get into the weeds of the investigation, they basically gave immunity to all the Astros players, anybody who was part of this club, and said, look, tell us what happened and nobody's going to get punished. So nobody who actually did the deed is getting punished in this thing. That's created a lot of bad will. And I definitely see what you're saying, and I agree with it, that baseball's been a sport where there's been a real solidarity. It's been a very strong player union kind of thing. It's not very accepted to speak out of turn against even an opponent. And so I think that caught baseball off guard, that guys are standing up here and saying, look, you know, this is unacceptable and these guys should be punished. And we should think about, you know, whether or not we want to put an asterisk on that 2017 World Series.
We're talking to Jason Gay from the Wall Street Journal about the Houston Astros sign stealing scandal. Jason, you wrote a piece a while back saying that baseball's biggest problem for a while there was people perceived it as boring. If they talked about it at all, it was about how boring it was. Now they're being talked about. Is that an improvement?
It's an interesting question, right? Because yes, in the abstract, there are more people talking about baseball. Is this the kind of conversation that baseball wants to have? I mean, maybe if they were borrowing a page from, you know, worldwide wrestling, right? The idea of heroes and villains being the thing that gets people excited about sports. Maybe there could be some net positive here. But I mostly see a sport that's really embarrassed by this whole thing. I can't even imagine what it's like to be an Astros fan. I mean, they have very passionate fans who are very prideful of that team. And for them to be sort of hit with this scarlet letter here, it's not the kind of like dust up that you want to use to get eyeballs.
Do you have thoughts on what the leadership of Major League Baseball could do after maybe not doing everything they need to do to start with? What could they do to restore faith and bring people back to the game itself?
Well, you know, another thing to keep in mind here is I'm not sure when there is going to be another shoe dropping, because as you might recall, the Red Sox are also under investigation for shenanigans they may or may not have pulled in their dugout with sign stealing. So there could be another opportunity for baseball to act here, and there could be a whole reprise of this with another big franchise. You know, for baseball, it's awfully hard to, you know, put the horse back in the barn. They decided to not, you know, punish the players. I don't know how they can retroactively go back and punish players. It seems very clear they are very reluctant to do anything with regard to penalizing the 2017 World Series.
Now, baseball is considering some rule changes in response, restrictions on who can be in the dugout and clubhouse, limits on smartphones and TV use during the game. I don't know. It's really easy to sneak a phone in somewhere. Is this something that's going to restore faith in this whole sign stealing thing?
I don't know. Right. It's funny though, isn't it? You know, baseball is regarded as our most traditional major sport, right? It's not terribly different from the game that they played at the turn of the century. Not this past century. Right. I mean, the century before that. The irony is here that it is in fact technology which allowed the Astros to exploit the system in the manner that they did. It is the video review technology, which is now available not just in the Astros dugout, but in every baseball dugout for managers and players to review blown calls and perhaps ask for instant replay. If you take that out of the game, listen, I'm not going to complain, because I think instant replay in virtually every sport is a disaster. I think it extends the play. I think taking the human element out of the game takes something away from it. I generally regard instant replay as an albatross around sports. So if you take it away from baseball, I'm not going to complain there. But I might be in the minority on that. There are an awful lot of people who seem to feel that everything has to be as accurate as possible at all times. And especially when you consider, you know, this is sounds like I'm talking far afield here, but how leagues increasingly are, you know, getting in business partnerships with betting and all that kind of stuff. There's it feels like an urgency around constant accuracy. So I don't know if they can sort of turn back the clock technologically to alleviate some of these problems or temptations.
So are you expecting some ugly scenes when the Astros show up, especially as the visiting team this year?
Well, I want to be on record as saying, like, I don't condone any kind of ugliness. I don't want to see a situation where Astros players are, you know, fearing for their health and their heads. You know, I don't that kind of retribution stuff. I know that is an old part of baseball, too. I'm not a big fan of that. I hope that doesn't happen. I do highly support, however, anything that fans want to do, as long as it's in the bounds of taste and hilariousness. I want to see garbage can night at virtually every Astros road game. I want to see people wailing away on hefty barrels. You know, every imaginable sign, every imaginable chant, as long again as is within taste, something, you know, you can do with your 9-year-old child. I highly support that. I think that will be the punishment we have all been looking for, and the cathartic thing that might allow baseball to turn the page. It's going to be wild. It really will. I mean, when the Astros come to your town, that's going to be a hot ticket.
Jason, I'll let you go to the hardware store and pick up a good noisy metal trash can.
Yeah, you really want to get the old-fashioned metal one, right?
Can I make
that
those?
Just really makes a big.
Yeah.
You don't want to get one of those plastic
That's
ones.
Nothing.
That's a tougher one.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Jason Gay is a sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal and a UW-Madison alum. We talked to him today about the Houston Astros sign-stealing scandal and what Major League Baseball is doing to limit cheating. Well, baseball fans, are you following this? What do you think of it, this Houston Astros pretty well-developed plan to steal opposing teams' signals and then signal batters on what pitch might be coming next? Are you among the many fans who are upset about this? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Do you think baseball should have done more to punish the organization, the Astros, the players involved, or do you think there's been enough already? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Time now for a follow-up on a conversation we had yesterday about the World Cheese Championship this week in Madison. Dean, yesterday, Dean Kinetter's here. We talked about the top 20 in the big grand prize category. Now we know what came out of it.
Well, as I said yesterday, we had three Wisconsin cheeses in the top 20, and my suspicions unfortunately came through.
Uh-huh.
None of them cracked the top three. The winner was a Gruyere from Switzerland, followed by a Grand Cru cheese from Switzerland, very similar, and then in third, a Gouda from the Netherlands.
All right. Now, have you ever tried these cheeses? Are these the kind of things that we can just like go to the store and buy? Are these really exclusive, rare cheese varieties?
I can't speak to the ones that placed in the top three this year. It depends kind of how much they produce, if they're able to export. I'm not certain about these ones. I've tasted a lot of similar cheeses, but not these ones in particular.
And now the Swiss Gruyere, that one, they've been here before. This isn't their first rodeo.
This cheese won in 2008 as well, and I guess that it is the first cheese now to two-peat as a world champion.
Wow. Okay, so you can come back and keep winning. Now, is this just a popularity contest, or what really goes into judging these things?
Technical perfection. I mean, you start at a score of 100, and judges take off tenths of points for little tiny technical errors. It is a really, good, technically perfect cheeses are what come out on top, and they tend to be from other countries.
All right, time to go shopping. Dean, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rob.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.